Now being joined by our guest, who's Dr. Ellen Moyer. She's an author, speaker, PhD, environmental engineer in Western Massachusetts. She's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and works on her third book titled Our Earth, Our Species, Ourselves, How to Have Fun Creating a Sustainable World. She's on one line and Vern's on the other. So, Ellen, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Oh, just great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Hi, Ellen. This is Vern.
V-E-R-N. Hey, Vern.
Can I call you Ellen?
Oh, please do. Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, now, the Earth Day, was there anything significant about 1970 as far as Earth Day is concerned?
Yeah, I was looking into the history more to get ready for this show, and it's really pretty interesting. Everything started with Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring about pesticides. This came out in 1962. And that book raised the public's awareness and concern for living things and also highlighted the links between pollution and public health. So it made environmental degradation personal because it affects us and our health. Now, Senator Gaylord Nelson in the U.S. Senate, he started Earth Day. The first one was April 22, 1970, because he had seen the ravages of a massive oil spill in Santa Barbara, California, the previous year. And that really got him going. And there were a lot of other issues, you know, of concern. So what he managed to do with the help of others was to create a so-called national teach-in on the environment. And it's kind of hard to imagine this now, but 20 million Americans took to the streets, parks, and auditoriums that day on Earth Day, and thousands of colleges and universities organized protests. And what everybody was demanding then was clean air, clean water, and a healthy, sustainable environment. And the government listened, and they acted. Very unlike today.
Well, let me contribute here a little bit.
Yeah.
I've been to China 5 times.
Wow.
I was one of the first 1,000 people.
Whoa.
To go into China when Nixon opened it up. In fact, I saw the tree that Nixon planted in China, and I had an occasion to tell him that I had good news and bad news. And he says, "What was the good news?" I says, "I found your tree that you planted in China." He said, "What's the bad news?" I said, "Your tree isn't doing too well."
Oh,
so, getting back to what we're talking about here, around Yunnan Province, which is down in the southwest part of China, there's awful lot of pollution.
Yeah.
I'm not gung-ho on Earth Day as you are. I'm concerned, but, you know, I don't lose sleep over it. But after being to China, and, even in the United States, I took a private plane and flew from the central part of Indiana into O'Hare Airfield at Chicago. And I said to the pilot, I said, "You know, what's that wall up there?" He says, "That's pollution." I said, "Oh, my God, you know, we're going to hit it." So those are two things that I have witnessed about pollution.
Yeah, when did you go to China, by the way?
Well, my God, it's been years and years and years. In fact, on one of the trips, I took my wife there, and she contacted something and was a fatal disease, and she came back, and about 8 or 9 months later, she died.
Oh my God!
So I'm an international journalist. I spent a lot of time behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I've worked with the president of Poland and. And I spent 40 minutes with the king of Saudi Arabia. I took one of my grandchildren into Saudi Arabia and introduced him to the king of Saudi Arabia. He got a big buzz out of that, you know.
Huh.
But anyhow, I think we've got to be reasonable about this whole thing.
Yeah, but just because somebody's worse doesn't mean this is okay.
But you know the problem you get into, no matter how good we are in the United States, let's say that we did everything right for air pollution. Let's say that we sacrificed or whatever we had to do. We're only part of the world. We're a small part of the world.
Yeah, but we lead the world, and so other people see what we're doing and often will follow suit. So, and that's no reason not to do anything. That argument often comes up with environmental stuff. Like, hey, if I preserve my forest here, somebody will go cut them down over there. Well, you can't really make any progress that way, so you have to do what you can in the area that you have control over. And those are just, I believe, excuses to not act.
Well, but if we can't get China, particularly, to cooperate with us, whatever we do is going to be good, but it isn't going to really be significant.
Well, but we can get them to cooperate with us, and plus, they hate air pollution just as much as we do, and they are getting so mad about the air pollution that it's going to change. So, they are
in the same position we were back in the 40s, and,
right?
And they're trying to get their system, their economic system up, and they need to develop energy and all.
Well, the thing is, though, that people don't have to go there. It isn't a given that you have to go through this polluting industrial step to develop. The hope is that people can jump over that destructive step and go right to clean technology. And they're actually doing pretty well with wind and solar, actually. So,
do you think wind and solar has a future for us?
Because more solar energy falls on the Earth than we need worldwide, something like in an hour, I think it is, that much energy falls on the Earth. And, you know, it has powered life.
And well, how do you feel? We have an abundance of coal in this country. Years and years ago, I was a member of the state police down in West Virginia. And of course, West Virginia is a coal state, and if we don't use coal, we lose a lot of this energy. What do you think of fracking?
I don't like fracking. I don't like coal. And if you look at West Virginia, those people are some of the poorest people in the country with the shortest lifespans. It's not like it's doing them any favors.
When I was down there, I was single, and I was dating some girls from West Virginia. And some of them even wore shoes.
Uh-huh.
I'm backing up what you said.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, you know, we have better options. You know, should we keep smoking cigarettes because it creates jobs for the tobacco industry? I mean, it's just, we should do what makes the most sense, and especially when we have options. So I worked for a solar company in the 1980s, and they were building beautiful solar houses, and they were fantastic. People loved them. Very pleasant. There was no sacrifice involved there. So we can do so much more with technologies that don't involve burning. That's what climate change is telling us, saying, hey, you know, got to stop burning things. That's it. There are plenty of other things we can do instead, and we're just not getting the message. So, you know, one example of why we need to act on this is provided by Hurricane Sandy. You know, in New York City, there was a storm surge of 13 feet, and one of those 13 feet was global sea level rise. And people have figured out that 1 foot of global sea level rise cost $7 billion in additional damages and also caused an additional 25 square miles to be flooded. Now, the latest research indicates that if we don't get our act together, we're going to have 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century. Now, just imagine what that would do to New York City. Well, imagine what it would do to the world.
What would it do to New Orleans?
Oh, same thing it would do to so many other cities that are located on coasts. people would have to relocate. Those areas would become uninhabitable.
What kind of a grade would you give the United States? What would you give them? An A? Would you give them an F? Would you give them a B, C? What kind of a grade would you give us?
Yeah, it's hard because there's the political system, there's entrepreneurs, I guess, but in general, I'd say maybe a D.
Really?
We're about 10 or 15 years behind Europe, so why, you know, what's up with that? We should be right up there or leading the way, especially if people want to grow the economy. The way to grow the economy is to be a leader, not a follower and a straggler. And we're doing a lot of digging in our heels and just resisting going with the flow of change. And it's going to cost us money, I think. It's going to cost us a lot of money, I think.
Well, how did the various presidents we had look at this?
Well, President Nixon was one of the best on environment. He's the one who was around on Earth Day. He's the one who started the Environmental Protection Agency, and under his watch, all this major environmental legislation got passed, so he was fantastic. And back then, it wasn't a partisan issue, you know. Those major environmental laws in 1970, they passed with overwhelming bipartisan support. So somehow things went astray and it became a partisan issue where Democrats are for a clean environment and Republicans say, no, let industry do whatever they want and just absorb the impacts. So I would say Nixon was one of the best, ironically. And Obama is pretty good. I keep wishing he would do more, but of course he's hamstrung by the people around him. But still, I think he could have done more and could do more. He still has time to do more.
Well, it's one of those things that whatever is going to occur is going to take time for it to occur.
Well, we don't have time. So that's the problem. You know, time is our most precious resource here. And if we keep stalling and procrastinating and delaying, we're going to pay. So we need to pick up the pace. The whole problem with species going extinct is because they don't adapt quickly enough to change.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say that we're doing a terrible job. We've got an F minus, and we just don't give a damn about this. What's our great-grandchildren going to have to suffer because of that?
Well, that would be the 6 feet of sea level rise. Can you imagine? Florida would be gone, pretty much. The cities would be uninhabitable. Think of the expense of creating new cities inland. I mean, it's just off the charts. So it's really much, much more economically intelligent to deal with climate change now. It'll cost way less than if we just let the thing spiral out of control. So young people are seeing that they are getting screwed. I mean, they see what's happening, and they're getting pretty angry about it, understandably so. And it's part of the reason they love Bernie Sanders. And you know, it's a matter of environmental justice, too, isn't it? Intergenerational justice. Do we have the right to trash the environment for future generations just because it's convenient for us? I mean, there's a real moral issue.
Have you analyzed the millennials and their attitude towards this? Because the millennials are coming on, and they're going to be our doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs here in a few years. And they're not very political, you know. Only about half of the millennials, those are people that were born after 1980, about 48%, they don't accept the Republicans and the Democrats. They're independents, and you know.
Yeah, I guess I don't know enough about it, really, but it seems like all generations have a high percentage of apathy. So I don't know how millennials compare with generations before and after, but you know, young people are getting fired up. They're getting involved in divestment efforts to have their colleges and universities sell their fossil fuel stocks. And we even have young people suing states and the federal government over inaction on climate change. This is a group called Our Children's Trust, and they just won a major victory in Oregon where a court said that, or a judge said, yes, your lawsuit can go forward. So they're suing the government because the government's job is to protect our situation here from threats, foreign and domestic.